Hello, I am the host of Shifting Culture, Joshua Johnson. I just want to come on before the episode and tell you all thank you for listening. Did you know that big things are coming for Shifting Culture and you can be a part of it? We have just launched a Patreon. When you become a monthly patron to the show, you will get our episode ad-free, get early access to episodes, be able to download episode guides, and get bonus shows. Go to patreon.com/shiftingculture to support all that we are doing. Your support means that we can continue to help the body of Christ look more like Jesus. Again, go to patreon.com/shiftingculture. Thank you so much. Now, on to the episode.
The very first starting point of any conversation or any relationship or any disagreement should be, sitting across from me is an image bearer. And that raises the bar quite a bit. I mean, it's not sort of optional, or some people are image bearers and some aren't. This person across from me is an image bearer. And that's a very profound statement about not just human beings, but the created order as we look at another person and what that asks us to do. So that should, I think, always be our first posture. And then we have to say, well, what do we do from there?
Hello, and welcome to the Shifting Culture podcast, in which we have conversations about the culture we create and the impact we can make. We long to see the body of Christ look like Jesus. I'm your host, Joshua Johnson. Go to shiftingculturepodcast.com to interact and donate. And don't forget to hit the follow button on your favorite podcast app to be notified when new episodes come out each week. And go leave a rating and review. It's easy, it only takes a second, and it helps us find new listeners to the show. Just go to the show page on the app that you're using right now and hit 5 stars. It really is that easy. Thank you so much. You know what else would help us out? Share this podcast with your friends, your family, your network. Tell them how much you enjoy it and let them know that they should be listening as well. If you're new here, welcome. If you want to dig deeper, find us on social media at Shifting Culture Podcast, where I post video clips and quotes and interact with all of you. Previous guests on the show have included John Art, Scott McKnight, and Shauna Pilgreen. You can go back, listen to those episodes and more. But today's guest is John Inazu. John Inazu is the author of Learning to Disagree, The Surprising Path to Navigating Differences with Empathy and Respect. He is the Sally D. Danforth Distinguished Professor of Law and Religion at Washington University in St. Louis. He teaches criminal law, law and religion, and various First Amendment courses. He writes and speaks frequently about pluralism, assembly, free speech, religious freedom, and other issues. He is the founder of the Carver Project and the Legal Vocation Fellowship, and is a senior fellow with Interfaith America. John and I have a great discussion about learning how to disagree civilly. We talk about the importance of seeing others as image bearers of God, developing empathy, even for those we disagree with, distinguishing facts from judgments, and finding common ground. John gave great examples of disagreeing respectfully from his legal and interfaith work. The postures of curiosity, patience, and commitment to relationships over time are crucial to this conversation. Join us as we learn how to disagree, hear one another, and walk forward gracefully. Here's my conversation with John Inazu. John, welcome to Shifting Culture. Really excited to have you on. Thank you so much for joining me.
Joshua, thanks so much. It's great to be with you.
Yeah, I'd love to have an introduction to you, where you're coming from. One thing that I know is that you have done some of your schoolwork both at Duke and North Carolina. So if we're talking about learning how to disagree, it seems like there's a disagreement probably within your soul and your body when Duke and North Carolina start to engage in basketball or anything else. How do you disagree with yourself? Like what's going on?
Yeah, the very astute observation. So I'll say that I have tremendous respect for both academic institutions. They've got
There you go.
Now, when it comes to sports, I'm definitely a Blue Devil at heart. And
all right,
I spent actually some time during graduate school tormenting UNC undergraduates with pictures of Duke basketball players. So sometimes I disagree by using power coercive tactics.
That's great. Well, my wife went to Wake Forest, and so there's another disagreement right there. Yeah, but there's some great institutions there. Now, you have made a career in law, and now as a law professor at Washington University. Law has a lot to teach us to do with arguments and persuasive speech. Does it have anything to teach us to do with coming together and being able to disagree and moving forward on the same page? Is that possible?
Yeah, well, I hope so. I mean, that's sort of but one of the points behind the book is to make that case to the average person who's not in law school, that law actually is really helpful. And I actually think that we can think of this on at least two levels. One is on a very heavy, serious level, law is the opposite of unchecked violence. And so we live in a law-ordered society for a reason, and that's a really good thing because the opposite of law is chaos or anarchy and violence. So even, you know, whatever we might think about the imperfections of our legal system, and there are many, we should probably recognize that having a structure of law in place is at root a very good thing. And so that's one way we can think about how law helps with disagreement. But I'm actually interested in a much more sort of down-to-earth, on-the-ground way that law helps us disagree. And this is the way in which some tactics, strategies, and habits that we learn and teach in law school can be useful and applied to everyday situations so that your coworkers or your neighbors or maybe even family members who struggle with this disagreement can learn some postures that we experience in law school and that can help kind of everyday relationships. And that's where a lot of this book is focused.
Well, I think it's a timely topic. It's a needed topic, especially in America. We have gone through a couple of really contentious election cycles, probably have another one this year, that, you know, even within the church, people decided to say, I disagree politically, so we can't worship together. I'm going to go worship somewhere else. We have a Protestant faith where there's 47,000 different denominations, and all of them were based mostly on a disagreement of saying, I disagree with you in this. We're going to set up a new denomination that has all the right things. And so we can't start to work together. So there's polarization. There's division because of our disagreements. Why do you think it's important that we start to learn how to have disagreements well, so we don't just stop the conversation and go into our silos so that we feel more comfortable?
Yeah, I really like how you set up that question, because what it points to is not just our present polarization, but the fact that we've had lots of splits in the past. Or the descriptive reality of American Protestantism testifies to a lot of disagreements over time. Denominations split over slavery and the Civil War, over women's ordination, all kinds of things in this country that leads us to the plurality of denominations we have. And of course, politically, we've had lots of really hard seasons in our country's past. We've had massive labor violence and unrest in the 1960s and all kinds of other examples. So in some ways, polarization isn't new, both in and out of the church. And we've had, you know, every generation has gone through really hard challenges where people line up on different sides of an issue and think, I can't believe these people I trusted, this group I was part of, this church community I thought was a family, is somehow fractured in many cases irrevocably over really hard issues. What makes it different today? Well, I think a couple of factors. One, I think there's a growing sense of the connectedness between, for Christians especially, these differences in church that are aligning with political and party differences, and how that is coming more and more into play for a lot of people. And the other thing that seems very new is the presence of social media. The past polarization, it just couldn't spread as quickly and holistically as it can today. Anytime you or I jump online to read something, things can go viral in a matter of minutes. And we're increasingly sorting into different preferred news sources and social media channels. And all of this means, I think, again, the polarization itself may not be that different, but the way that we consume it and experience it feels like it's just everywhere all the time. I sometimes think, like, you know, probably when you and I were growing up, we got the news at most twice a day, the morning paper, you know, as I was heading off to school. And then maybe if I'm home in time, I catch the evening news. And, you know, there were still serious issues of disagreement and really hard issues going on. But most of the rest of the day, I wasn't really thinking about them. I was living the rest of my life. And now for a lot of people sitting at the workplace or checking their phones, it's just this constant barrage of here's the latest breaking news and here's reinforcing your priors about those people or our team. And that just happens over and over day in and day out. And I think it's not surprising that that really entrenches our felt differences.
We go into different camps of news camps where it's really it's really more opinion than news. There's like, hey, this happened. Here's our opinion on it. And here's somebody else's opinion on it. How can we start to even engage the news when opinions are coming at us all the time, right away, and we just don't even know what the context is?
Yeah, and this is where another area where I think that just the basic architecture of law can be helpful. So law often, whether it's in a case that's reported or a judicial decision or teaching in a classroom, lawyers and law students divide up the world into facts and judgments. And it's very useful and helpful first order distinction to say there are some facts of the world that are not opinions. Is today Monday, right? Is it 75 degrees outside? Wherever, it's not 75 here, but wherever it is, there are observable facts of the world. And sometimes those get contested. You know, we could say, did you make the filing on time? And maybe on time is a contested. But those are much different than judgments. Judgments occur when, for example, there's a homicide and there's a question of whether that homicide is self-defense. And that legal judgment of self-defense, which one side might say is obviously correct and another might say is obviously wrong, those are inevitably a form of opinion tied up in decision-making and authority and all kinds of things. And then you and I make all kinds of opinions in the rest of our lives, right? Did we think that sermon was good or appropriate or boring? Or is that person kind or evil? And those are inevitably somewhat subjectivized opinions. But I think in today's culture, it's especially important and useful to distinguish those buckets and to say, and at the end of the day, there are facts of the world and we should be able to talk about facts and hold each other to account of actual facts.
As you get into your book, the very first thing that you get into is how do we learn empathy is your question. And I think empathy is the perfect place to start. When we have disagreements, we have to see somebody as human. What are ways that we could start to engage with disagreements and have empathy for the person or the people that we're disagreeing with?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think especially for Christians, the very first starting point of any conversation or any relationship or any disagreement should be sitting across from me is an image bearer. And that raises the bar quite a bit. I mean, it's not sort of optional or some people are image bearers and some aren't. It's this person across from me is an image bearer. And that's a very profound statement about not just human beings, but the created order as we look at another person and what that asks us to do. So that should, I think, always be our first posture. And then we have to say, well, what do we do from there when it's really hard? And I might be able to say cognitively, yes, this is an image bearer, but I really don't like the person. And there, I think we can rely on a couple of tools. I mean, there are just sort of everyday practices like, can we listen well? Can we be patient with another person? And then we also have the fruits of the Spirit to guide us. Can we, in relying on the fruits of the Spirit, can we demonstrate these ways of engaging with the person across from us? And then finally, maybe at the most practical or ordinary level, but also really important, is just finding everyday common ground connection points. This is why I think food is so great. You know, sharing a meal with someone can really go a long way to ease or break some barriers. Having normal conversation. So if you're gonna jump into a really hard area of disagreement, one way to gain empathy first is to start with common connections that don't revolve around the disagreement. Find out something you have in common, or do an activity together in common before you jump in. And so these are some of these ideas seem kind of basic, but they're very hard to put into practice, and we have to be aware of them as we practice them.
Well, it seems to me that if we have empathy, but the person that we're talking to doesn't have empathy across, it's going to be still a really difficult conversation. How do we start to engage in places where it is empathy on one side, but not the other?
Yeah. And so, I mean, again, here's where I think Christians have just such a bounty of resources to draw upon. So in some ways, the ways in which we're asked to engage with other people aren't really conditional on how those people treat us. Love your enemy, be patient to those around you. Right? And that's, so that's part of the answer is, even if our empathy is not reciprocated, then we're still called to love and be kind. But I think there might be another way to get at this, which is to say, if we're very secure in who we are, what we believe, why we're in this world, we should actually be able to take a few hits. And when people treat us without empathy or caricature us or say unfair things, it doesn't mean that we should let every outrageous claim or every mistaken comment go unchallenged. I mean, I think there's a real importance of speaking truth and justice in the world. But on an individual level, if we can condition ourselves just to take less offense less quickly and to be able to hang in there and think, you know what, I didn't like the way you said that to me, or I think you're wrong in your characterization. But instead of immediately getting defensive or reactive, maybe I'll just say, well, can we complicate that a bit, or can we unpack that claim? And I think to encourage continued dialogue, even when we're not receiving empathy from the other side, is one way, not only how we effectively engage with other people, but it's also, I think, an important form of witness.
Yes, I think it is important to be that witness and to start to figure out, how do we love our enemies? How do we embody Jesus in our conversations? What does it look like to be like Jesus? You know, when Jesus called us to love our enemies, he said at the end of that sermon, if you hear these words of mine and you put them into practice, you're going to be like the wise builder who builds his house on the rock. And that's going to take us a long way if we put those things into practice. A lot of times we move into the disagreement in the dialogue world, right? So we're trying to dialogue with people. But some people say, okay, we've had enough conversation about this. How can we go from dialogue into action and to practically see that we could still be together and walk forward even while we disagree? Yep. What is the practical application of these conversations?
So a couple of things there. One is one useful consequence of recognizing that we live in an imperfect and fallen world means that in the political, legal, and policy realms, we should expect less than everyone being happy. We should just know that's going to be a fact of the world. And most political solutions, most legal solutions in our country, where there's lots of difference, are going to have winners and losers. And we might someday be among the winners, and we might someday be among the losers. We're still called to be citizens and neighbors. And so one way to engage practically is to recognize, I mean, it's a tragic dimension of living together with other human beings in a fallen world, which is that we will not always be satisfied, and yet we're still called to engage productively as citizens. And maybe sometimes that means we engage by trying to undo a policy or to push for change in a way that still loves the people around us. But I also think there's another dimension to this, and this is maybe what you were suggesting in your question, which is to say that in the real world, we're going to have to partner with a lot of people who don't agree with us on everything. It's the essence of finding common ground. It's the way that actual policies happen. And if we really mean it when we say we love our neighbors, that also means we're going to have to love our neighbors well with people who aren't Christians, with people who don't believe in any form of God, with people who are sometimes very opposed to us on certain legal and policy positions. But when we find those areas of common ground, you know, if at the end of the day, the question is, how do we stack sandbags in a flood zone, or how do we get food to kids who don't have it, then we should be doing that work with anyone who's willing to partner, rather than sort of doing a doctrinal test with them or worried about how it might look to be seen with them. And I think there are actually, when we really get down to the local and how we care for the social fabric around us, there are just almost an unending number of opportunities and examples where we can partner with people who are different than us, put our words into action, and not compromise who we are, what we believe, but just find common ground.
I lived in the Middle East and I sat in a lot of Muslim living rooms, had lots of discussions over a meal, and found a lot of common ground. And of course, I had an objective. I wanted to point them to Jesus and say, the way of Jesus is the way that brings life and flourishing. But I was still able to sit in when they go, I don't believe any of that, and see that we have a lot of common ground. We could have conversation and civil conversation, and we don't have to be angry at one another. We have a difference of beliefs. How important is it? I know that you have done a lot of interfaith work as well, that you have been, you know, friends and walking side by side with Muslims and Christians together. How do you go into that space, know that you have disagreements, even in belief systems, but still working for a common cause together?
Yeah, you know, and I think it's knowing what you believe, because I think when you're clear about what you believe, it makes it easier to know where the boundaries are. So with my Muslim friends, there are a whole lot of things that I will do with them, and there are some things I won't do. I won't pray with them together, but we can do a lot of good in the world together. And I don't feel a threat at all. But I also, and I think you kind of alluded to this in your question with your own examples, these are not sort of instrumental friendships. They are real friendships. And at the end of the day, what matters deeply to me is that Eboo Patel is my friend, and he's going to call me when he's hurting or when I'm hurting. And we still have very significant disagreements about things that really matter, but he's a friend, and we can partner effectively and well, but it's the friendship or it's a trust, and you can't really fake that. And I think, you know, sometimes I think especially in the 1990s, there were some sort of mission context or training that suggested this kind of friendship of evangelism it was really kind of an instrumental use of friendship. And I don't think that's a very effective way to be embedded in people's lives.
So there's a few things. You know, when I was a missionary in the Middle East, it was really easy for me to work side by side with other missionaries from different organizations, ones that have different approaches than we do. Even though we disagreed on a lot of different things, we're like, hey, there's some practical needs on the ground that we need to work together. But when I now step back and as a executive of an organization, working together with other organizations, I have some other things that I have to worry about. I have to worry about our own donors, and we have all sorts of different competing things. It's harder to work together at a higher level than it is on the ground. I think on the ground, it's almost easier. And it's a good example that we could say on the ground, you could do it. But how do we move it up the ladder a little bit and have organizations or work together and disagree, but still move towards a common purpose?
Yeah, this is such a great case study. I'm really glad you brought it up. I think that the institutional question is so important right now, and it's actually the cause of a lot of the pressure and fracturing we're feeling within Christian communities and institutions. And I think part of the answer is when you are clear on what your purpose is, then your various constituents should be on board to support the purpose. Or, you know, there are lots of other organizations to join out there, but your purpose defines your boundaries. And when you have an institutional purpose, that should tell you the parameters within which you can play and partner and cooperate. And it'll set some lines too, right? So you're not going to be able to do everything with everyone. But the key, I think, is to be able to articulate what the purpose is and then make sure that everyone from your board on down is committed to that purpose. And sometimes that means that someone who might disagree with what the organization's doing, but if you're committed to it in whatever role, as a board, a donor, an executive, sort of on the ground employee, you are committed to putting the good of the organization above your disagreements. And if you're not able to do that, and there's not necessarily a right or wrong answer here, the only wrong answer, I think, is if you hold on to the institution without an actual commitment to what it's doing, right? So probably at the end of the day, the best answer for some donors is to say, you're not really on board with this mission, right? You were too much in conflict and you should be giving elsewhere, or we should not be taking your money. And this is, when the rubber hits the road or when the dollars actually come out, that's a very hard line to walk, but I think it's the right line. And I think over time, that kind of clarity, which is an expressive clarity, but also a relational clarity, that will help organizations be healthier and help them cooperate in a more healthy and authentic manner than always trying to do this dance of, who's thinking what and how can we hold on to this group while we are over here. It doesn't make it easy, but I think it sets the parameters of how we ought to be engaging.
You talk a little bit in your book here, you talk about compromise. I think sometimes compromise can be healthy. Sometimes you're compromising some values. What happens when you can't go as far as the person that you're talking to or the people that you're talking to want you to go, that you actually have a value, you have a stance or a belief or something where you say, I can't actually compromise on that. And what does it look like in that tension?
Yeah. And so this takes me back to an earlier point in our conversation where I just think a fact of the world, a world of difference and diversity means that we are going to have really hard issues where we can't compromise. There are, when you think about lots of national policy questions, it's not like you can take one extreme and another extreme and just kind of find a happy middle ground and call it a day, right? Often it's going to be, this is legal or this is illegal, right? Or we are going to pursue this as a country or not pursue it. And when you're in those situations as an individual or an organization, there will be times when you have to say, I can't be on board with that partnership or that kind of compromise. And so you've got to step out of whatever arrangement or partnership you were in, and that might be very costly. Now, in stepping out, and I'm now thinking about, when we think about the landscape of American Protestantism, lots of fracture and fissure, whether it's the United Methodist Church or the Episcopal Church and the Anglicans, or we can name any number of splits that come or are coming. And those are all examples where different groups of people have said, we can't compromise on this issue. This is too central. This is too core. And there are, and as you mentioned, tens of thousands of tragic splits within our Protestant heritage that to kind of bear witness to this phenomenon. And I think sometimes these splits are inevitable because this stuff does matter. And sometimes you can't compromise. Where I do wish and hope for more grace, though, is that once the break happens, once the lack of compromise has been established and people go ways and sometimes split institutions or lose jobs, and we can recognize that's really hard, that's really painful, the stakes are high, and yet we should still be able to treat the people on the other side of that split with some kind of grace and kindness. I mean, they are still not only image bearers, but they're still also often claiming the name of Christ. It doesn't mean we're going to be able to worship with them in the same way, but we have to demonstrate a kind of empathy and kindness to them for their sake, but also for the sake of everyone else who's watching us squabble internally about these things.
That's good. I'd love for you to give an example of a policy or something that is we have a lot of disagreement on and division. And then walk us through how we could have a conversation and have empathy on both sides, figure out, hey, where can we go one way? Where can we go another way? And start to walk forward together, maybe to find a solution to some of these big problems that we have really a polarized opinions on either side.
Yeah. So I'll give you an example that I talk about in the book. And it's actually, I think it illustrates basically a no compromise example, but we can talk about the posture of engagement. So one of the cases I discuss is the Colorado case about the gay wedding and the cake baker, and the evangelical Christian cake baker by conscience says, I can't bake this for your wedding. I'll bake the cake for another celebration, your birthday or whatever, but I can't do it for your wedding. And the couple says, we want you to bake the cake for this, the wedding. We're just buying a cake from your store. We have a right to commerce. And so this goes to the courts and eventually, you know, for complicated reasons, goes up to the U.S. Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court says, no, that in this case, at least, the baker doesn't have to bake the cake. The couple can go get the cake from another restaurant. So in terms of how to think through that disagreement, and I think this takes us back first to empathy, this is a hard case. These are real people, and this is a complex case. And when I watched the news coverage of this case as it unfolded, neither side made it sound like a hard case, right? If you were for the baker, then the couple was just making it up, and you know they were just activists out to stir up trouble. And if you were for the couple, then the baker was just a bigot and couldn't possibly have a sincere religious belief. And it's pretty clear to me that on the ground, all of these human beings actually deeply cared about what they were doing, and they felt experiences and had these interpersonal connections and losses. And it's a hard question, and maybe it's even harder because of local differences. So maybe in Denver, where this case actually happened, and there happened to be, you know, 10 other bakeries down the street that would have baked the cake, that's one. But if you were in a small town in the rural South where there might be one bakery and the couple wouldn't have anywhere else to go, that could be a very different circumstance. And then we can disagree about that. You know, we could say from either direction, no, there should be an absolute rule on one side or the other. In our country, you know, with some help from the Supreme Court and state and federal legislatures, we'll sort this out over time. It might not get to an arrangement that anyone, you know, in particular likes at any given time. But I think if we start from the humanity of the people and the complexity of the situation, then we can at least recognize why this is hard and why the solution is not going to satisfy everyone. And then we can also say, well, and maybe other context matters, right? Maybe a cake is one thing, but a pastor or a wedding singer is something else. And maybe a Marriott hotel is something else. And I think if we take the time to think through the difficulty of this, then we can at least realize that it's not always as cut and dry as sometimes the pundits make it out to be.
I mean, that's a great example, because that's a difficult decision. But you're in America, you know, we could go back into law. You're looking at personal cases with humans that have all sorts of emotion on either side that want some beliefs. And then if it goes to the Supreme Court or even in lower courts, there's a precedent that's set, right? And so a lot of times people look back on the precedent and that was set with a decision in something that people are disagreeing on. And then we go back and say, okay, that's what it's going to be like from now on. And it'll be easy for us to make this decision. So sometimes that actually helps solve some systemic problems, but sometimes it muddles it. What is the role of precedent in law in solving some of these disagreements that we have?
Yeah, as you were talking, I was thinking, well, we probably need a semester-long seminar in jurisprudence to answer that. I'll do my best at this.
Sure. Thanks. For someone who's never gone to law school, I need something.
Yeah. Good question. And I think, you know, I think the answer is precedent is complicated, and it's neither absolutely predictable nor all made up. Right. And we actually have people in society and people in law who want to push for either extreme. Some people say, you're just making it up. There is no law. The Supreme Court does what it wants. I don't believe that's true. It's also not true that precedent lays out exactly what the answer is going to be, or that judges can just read the precedent and know. But the very nature of what we're doing in the law is setting up facts and law together in a way that tries to solve problems, and then a new problem or a new variation of the problem comes along. And then judges and lawyers have to figure out, well, is this close enough to what just happened that we agree with it or not? Or, and then this makes them even more complex, or is this decision, this precedent that we made, was it just wrong, right? Was Was it wrong to say that racial segregation was okay at one time in our country's history? Yes. Well, why? We have to look back and say that some precedents work and some don't work. And then some apply to certain situations and not others. That's why lawyers get paid a lot of money, is to figure this stuff out. But I think, you know, underlying this point is, it's really important to believe in something called the practice of law, meaning that legal decisions stand in as an alternative to pure politics, or, as I mentioned earlier, just total anarchy. And there are lots of people who want to give up on that and say, no, this is just a big political game. I don't think that's true at all. I think law matters. I think good lawyering and good judging matters. It doesn't mean that these imperfect human beings are always going to get it right. And it also doesn't preclude the raw political actors. So yes, there are judges and legislators and others who are just being political, but overall, there's something called law that works through precedent, that, you know, people go to law school and are licensed to practice law and are subject to malpractice requirements in order to keep doing the thing that we're doing. And I think, you know, it's easy, I know, for people who aren't lawyers to get very frustrated when they read about, you know, a couple of cases that don't go the way they would have liked or they don't understand. But when you look at the entire apparatus of the law and the hundreds and thousands of cases that are unfolding each year that hold the country together in very ordinary and very complex ways, I think I'm really grateful to be part of that apparatus.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's important. I think as believers, as Christians that want to follow the way of Jesus, that want to be faithful to Jesus, one of the things that he does really well is he ushers in justice. And he ushers in justice for, you know, the poor, the marginalized, neglected people that have been on the outside of society, and he wants to bring them in. And he's for all people. And so how does law and this conversation that we're having about civil disagreements, how does the role of Jesus and justice enter in as a person of faith?
Yeah, I think for Christians to be able to point to Jesus and the cross and the resurrection as ultimate justice that transcends our worldly interactions, when we think about what that actually means, that's incredibly powerful. And it's not just a difference in degree, it's a difference in kind of any sort of worldly justice. So worldly justice at best is proximate justice, right? The kind of justice that can be meted out by people or judges or police officers or prison officials is always going to be imperfect. You know, when you or I experience a deep wrong in this world at the hands of another human being, there's no way that wrong is ever fully remedied. There's a breach in the cosmos or the universe, and, you know, forever. This is really easy to think about when you think about a kind of a bodily harm or a murder or something. But it's true with any kind of injustice. When the injustice occurs, there is no justice. There's proximate justice. There's a kind of fine or punitive measure that can be given out, but it's not going to bring full justice. And so where does that leave us? Well, as Christians, it leaves us with the possibility of forgiveness, and forgiveness can be that one human act we can actually take unilaterally that ends the cycle of vengeance and that frees us from the injustice that has been done. That doesn't make it easy, but it's a possibility that should just give us tremendous hope. And then alongside forgiveness, and for Christians, I think inseparable from forgiveness is recognizing that, oh, there is this final justice, and we are headed for a big J justice where the created order is reconciled, and we hold out that hope, even knowing now that we're just going to experience imperfect examples of that in our own world and lives.
So how do you not lose hope, knowing that we only have proximate justice on earth, that we're going to continue with all sorts of evil and disagreement and back and forth, and there's going to be some little J justice, but not all of it until the consummation? How do we continue with hope that we can live in a society where we do see some foretastes of the coming kingdom of God, and it's there's some beauty in it.
Yeah, well, I think you just answered the question, which is we see an experience of foretaste, and we do that in all kinds of ways with other Christians and worship by recognizing the presence of God in our lives, by looking at the created order, by looking at even my friend Jamie Smith recently said this to me, and it stuck, the idea that we look for beauty in unexpected places, right? And we can see God's presence even in the midst of just awful circumstances. When we see that, we are testifying to that hope that is beyond us, even at points of despair. And then I think we recognize and remind each other that we are part of a very long story that is going to unfold over many generations and certainly past our own lifetimes. And I think that helps us maintain hope in the midst of imperfect and proximate justice, because we look at examples from Scripture. We look at the Jews in Babylon in exile, and the promise is not, you know, in your lifetime, everything's going to work out and you will find justice and peace. It is, settle into this place that's really hard, raise children, have them raise children, be faithful, love your neighbors, and sometime along the way, I will rescue you. That's a very hopeful message, but it's not a hope that is limited to you or me as individual people. It's a promise of hope to a people embedded in a story, and I think that's how we cling to that hope.
That's beautiful. That's wonderful. I love that. That's so good. So if we want to start to engage in disagreement with others, I just want to know, for us as people, what posture do we take? What are helpful postures for us practically?
Yeah, I mean, so one is just curious, right? A kind of engagement that wants to learn. I found in my own life that almost everybody has something to teach me, even the person that is the least informed or the most annoying, that if I listen well and ask good questions, I can learn something. So a posture of curiosity, a posture of patience that is willing to ask follow-up questions. And here, I think a very practical point is, if you find yourself wanting to pursue an issue or a set of issues across disagreement with the real desire of learning and trying to gain empathy, then one of the best ways to do this is to split it up in different conversations over time. So have an initial conversation with a commitment to come back in a week or in 2 weeks. You know, because what that does is it gives both you and the other person an opportunity to reflect on what's been said. You don't feel like you have to win the argument in one sitting or squeeze it all in. And you could even go back and, you know, say, well, you know, I actually never thought of that point or that idea, and I'm going to do some reading about it just to be better informed. And so that posture of patience and a willingness to commit to a relationship. And then I think, you know, going back to a point we made earlier is thick skin is probably not the right term, but something like that, where we take some, we can be ready to receive some imperfect or offensive comments without immediately going on the defensive or immediately jumping on the other person. And, you know, I've found sometimes when I don't always do this perfectly, but when I am in situations where I do that and I can kind of hang in there with the conversation, sometimes I find out, oh, actually, this is a little more nuanced than I thought, or this person didn't quite mean that, or I'm able to get someone to recognize that the unqualified overclaim statement was not actually what they meant, and they actually meant something different.
Can you give us a tip or two to engage in social media in a way that does some of this? Because I know nuance is really hard in social media. You would say, get off of it. All right.
Yeah. it is really hard. So I think, frankly, I think the best social media tip I can give is to draft responses that you don't actually send. I mean, actually write them out. You know, your own kind of witty, snarky retort, whatever it is, or you're like expressing your deeply held view about something, write it out, don't send it. Just leave it in a file for at least a day. Wait at least a day. Now, sometimes social media makes you think, well, if I don't respond in 5 minutes, I've missed the conversation. Not true, right? You don't, waiting a day or half a day is not going to marginalize your voice. So write it out, wait, and then ask yourself, is this really as important as I thought it was? So for me, one of the best moves I've done recently in the last few years is I started a couple of years ago a weekly Substack newsletter. And what that did practically for me, it meant I was less engaged on Twitter and other social media. But what it meant is when I came across something on social media that really bugged me or I thought was super important, I would just put it in a file and then wait until I was ready to write my weekly newsletter. And if it was really that important, I would then spend a bunch of time thinking through it and making the point. And 9 times out of 10 or 19 out of 20, turned out that a couple of days later, it wasn't really that important.
Yeah, that's so good. What's one hope you have for your readers? What do you want them to get from this book?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I hope that I wrote it in a way that is engaging so that people feel like they're learning something, but also it's entertaining, that they'll laugh a couple times, that they'll be frustrated, they'll pause. So I hope it's the kind of book that can both challenge substantively, but also engage and captivate the reader.
Yeah, I think you did a good job there. I was laughing, I was learning. It was a fantastic read. So I think you did phenomenally. I'm really excited for people to start to engage it. And hopefully we can learn how to disagree and have these postures of humility and learning and curiosity, and that we could have discussions and even disagree and continue to move forward together and see that there is an image bearer in front of me. It's really, really good. I have a couple of questions for you, John. One, if you go back to your 21-year-old self, what advice would you give?
I love that question. I think, you know, especially speaking as a Christian, I think it would just be to not overthink where life will take you, because you actually can't game it out. You can't have a plan for the next 20 years of your life. So to be faithful in the little steps, but to hold it loosely. And when I talk to students who are 21, that's sort of the advice I give. You know, you know some things you're called to today. But you don't actually know where you're going to be in 20 or 30 years. So don't hold that a little more loosely, I think.
Yeah, that's really good. Good advice. Anything you've been reading or watching lately you could recommend?
I'm actually getting ready to go to Kenya in a couple of days. And so I've been reading up on the Kenyan constitution, but I don't think that I would recommend that. It's probably not the exact point here. But I will say I've recently read a book on faith and politics by my friend Michael Ware, and I thought that was he builds on Dallas Willard, and I think the for those people who are interested in politics and political engagement, the idea that spiritual practices and Christian community seems really, really important. So that's what comes to mind.
Excellent. So The Spirit of Our Politics by Michael Ware. Michael will be on the Shifting Culture on the podcast just a couple of weeks from this conversation as it drops. So that'll be great. Maybe listen back to back. It'll be good for you. How can people connect with you, John? Go out, get your book, Learning to Disagree. And where would you like to point people to?
Yeah, thanks so much. So, yeah, I mean, would love for people to engage with the book if they're interested. I also do have that free weekly Substack, johnanazu@substack.com. And I've got a website, johnanazu.com, that has quite a bit of information about what I do and where I go and what I teach.
Awesome. Well, John, thank you for this conversation. I think it was necessary. It's needed in our day and age that we need to figure out how to disagree with one another, how to engage in conversation. I think we've lost some of this. And so we need to regain the ability to do that. And so I really enjoyed your book. And I hope they go out, they get it, they learn, and they practice with one another. So practice with some people that are safe at the beginning. Because I think if we do practice, we get better at it over time. And I think for people like you, as we need some examples, that people can be an example, that we can have disagreements and we can still be together and move forward together. And so Yes, I hope this is one of them and one good example for people to take. So thank you for your work. Thank you for this conversation. It was fantastic.
It was great to be with you. Thanks so much, Joshua.
Thanks. Thank you so much for listening to this episode. If you want to see more episodes like this, go to patreon.com/shiftingculture and become a monthly patron of the show. You can help us produce more episodes so that we can see the body of Christ look more like Jesus. If you become a patron on patreon.com/shiftingculture, you will get early access to episodes. You will get episode guides. You will get bonus shows, hopefully, and more. So go to patreon.com/shiftingculture and become a monthly patron. Also, leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. It really helps us out and helps us find new listeners to the show. And just go and share this podcast with your friends, your family, your network, people that you think would enjoy it as well. Thank you again for listening to the show. I hope you have a great week.